Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. The drama continues to unfold in the Middle East. Increasingly, it's playing out here in America as well. To my chagrin, the stories we track are taking on a political dimension here in this country. We're going to try to make sense of these twists and turns the best we can, three times a week, based on the best sources available. In a few minutes, you'll get a chance to hear from journalist Mati Friedman. He's the author of four books. He's a former reporter at the Associated Press. He's a truly insightful observer of Middle East affairs. We're tickled pink that he's agreed to come on the show. But first, I want to talk about the politics of this war. Mao Zedong famously said that politics is war without bloodshed. Renowned military strategist Karl von Clausewitz observed that war is politics by other means. In short, politics and war are inextricably intertwined. But I am deeply alarmed right now to see America's domestic politics creep into the Gaza war. After initially standing unabashedly with Israel, President Biden now seems to believe that taking a tougher stance on Israel will play well with certain constituencies he thinks he needs to woo as our election cycle kicks into high gear. And so he's attacked Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu personally. He has tried to alienate the Israeli people from their elected leader, and he's openly meddling in the domestic affairs of a democratic ally. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I carry no water for Bibi. He's made plenty of mistakes before this war and since, but this is not a good look for the leader of the free world. Beyond that, it seems like Israel is the only Middle East actor taking heat from the White House right now. I mean, where are the statements against Iran for funding and training all those terrorist groups that have been attacking not just Israel, but American servicemen since this war began? Where are the efforts to turn the Iranian people against their oppressive regime? What about Turkey and Qatar, two of Hamas's other big patrons? Rather than locking horns with them, our top diplomats have engaged in fawning high-level dialogues with their Hamas-funding leaders in recent weeks. Yikes. Nobody ever said that being a wartime president is easy. But this is going to damage American credibility if it continues. Remember, Mr. President, it's not just American voters who are watching. Now for your headlines. Headline one. Sky News Arabia reports that Hamas is coordinating with Hezbollah to embark on the next phase of the war. No surprise here. We all know that these two groups have been working closely together for years, but Hezbollah has significantly increased its attacks on Israel in recent days and weeks. And this comes amidst a relative lull in the fighting in Gaza. It looks as if Hezbollah is preparing for the battle that everyone has tried to avoid. So now what? On the one hand, Israel has been fighting on two fronts for months now. But if Hezbollah takes things much further, it would signal an entirely different kind of war. Some in Israel argue it's time for Israel to drop the gloves and hammer Hezbollah after 5 months of attacks. Probably true. But I fear that we can't quite see the big picture. Hezbollah has just had a preview of what a devastating war against the IDF would look like for the past 5 months, and yet somehow they are not deterred. This is the part where I ask myself, what are we missing? Headline two. A Palestinian from Jenin was planning to carry out a suicide attack in Tel Aviv, but was thwarted by Israeli security. The Second Intifada, which raged from 2000 to 2005, saw dozens of suicide bombings. But between the Israeli security fence, preemptive IDF operations in the West Bank, and security cooperation with the Palestinian Authority, the tactic has lost steam over the years. But here's the thing. Suicide bombings are usually the end result of a long process of indoctrination. Are there more potential suicide bombers in the West Bank? I'm betting the Shin Bet is working overtime to learn more if they haven't already. And headline three, Channel 12 in Israel announced yesterday that Israel allowed six aid trucks into the northern Gaza Strip. This is big, folks. For reasons that were not quite clear to me, the IDF was not allowing in aid from the north of the enclave. But when the trucks came in from the south, Hamas was able to divert the aid and exploit it. The aid is now flowing to areas that Hamas does not control. This is just a pilot program. But if the IDF assesses that this could one day become the new normal, there are real benefits. Once Gazans sheltering and Rafah understand that there is more aid to the north, they might be willing to leave. And that could begin to clear out the 1.4 million people that Israel needs to relocate before the battle for Rafah begins. This could be, just maybe, the beginning of some much needed change. Okay, now for the moment you've all been waiting for. Mati Friedman is a talented journalist and an author based in Israel. He's now a writer at the Free Press, which is a terrific publication. Mati's articles challenge conventional thinking. His books are always thought-provoking and often profound. He's the kind of guy that experts really must read if they want to keep being experts. So he's a perfect guest for the FDD Morning Brief. Welcome, Mati Friedman.
Morning.
All right. Well, first, let me ask you about the state of our media. You wrote a groundbreaking story about a decade ago exposing the extent to which Western media in Gaza played by Hamas's rules. Now that Hamas has lost power, do you think that our media here, Western media, do you think they're performing any better than they were a decade ago?
I wish the answer was yes. And I'd love to, you know, look at the world getting constantly better and people learning from their mistakes. But it's quite clear that the answer is the opposite, that the problems that I described about a decade ago in that piece, I was an essay for Tablet followed up by an essay for The Atlantic, two pieces which are basically the same essay in two parts. The problems that I saw then have only become more pronounced and more widespread. I initially thought that this was a problem specifically related to Israel coverage, and that's what you'll see if you read those essays now. What's pretty clear from 2024 is that the problem of a press that does less and less explanatory journalism and more ideological activism, that's obviously a problem that is much broader than coverage of one Middle Eastern country. And it's really pervaded almost every corner of the media world on the left and the right. And in 2024, it's very difficult to find any kinds of journalism that aren't ideological activism. And that leads a lot of people very confused about what's going on in the world. It also means that a lot of people are just living in silos of information and believing whatever self-reinforcing propaganda is being thrown their way. And we're certainly seeing that play out in this conflict. When I look at the way people are responding to it in the West, it's clear that most people have absolutely no idea what's really going on.
What do you think the source of this is? I mean, how did we get here?
Well, I think that, I mean, you said we have 17 or 18 hours to discuss this, right, John? So everyone will just stick with us. The sources are multiple. One part of it is the collapse of the economic model of the old press. Another part of it is the rise of social media and the kind of atomization of the media landscape. Part of it is this kind of new ideological movement, one we don't really know how to name, but this kind of hard left ideology that over the past 10, 20 years seems to have really hollowed out and taken over many previously liberal institutions, the press being one part of that, but the academy being another part of it, certainly the NGO world, organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and the ACLU, and organizations that meant one thing 20 or 30 years ago now mean something completely different. And I would include in that many of the big press organizations, including the one where I used to work. So there's been this rise of this new ideology, which is very influential. And some people call it woke. I don't like that name. And some people call it, I mean, I don't know what they call it, but it's quite clear that many of our institutions have come under the sway of this very simplistic binary idea that the world is made up of oppressors and the oppressed, and that the job then of journalists is not to describe the world, because doing so might actually play into the hands of oppressors. The job of a journalist or a professor or a human rights expert is to lobby for the oppressed. So you identify the side that's oppressed and you make sure that the information that you're putting out there is serving the right people and not the wrong people. That's activism and it's not journalism. And it's one reason that reality on planet Earth has become almost impossible to understand.
Okay, that's depressing. Let me hopefully move into something a little less depressing. You argued that Israel is too dependent upon technology. This was, I guess, several months ago before the war began. After 5 months in fighting in Gaza, do you think that that is still true? I mean, I look at the reservists and the boots on the ground And yes, of course, there's drones and there's high tech, but this does seem like the people's war. Am I wrong here?
No, it's certainly true that the society is mobilized and fighting. And of course, there's a lot of tech involved in the fighting, but it's involves a lot of just boots on the ground slogging through the alleys in a way that I think would be familiar to infantrymen in Stalingrad or, you know, in urban battles 50 years ago, 7 years ago, even more. The article that I wrote about tech, I wish I'd written it before the war started, and then I would have been a genius and a prophet. It was written after the war started, which makes me merely, I guess, a conscious observer of what's going on, because one big part of the failure on October 7th was that the entire defense array around Gaza was based on tech. So you didn't have thousands of soldiers in foxholes spread along the Gaza fence. We had barely any infantry along the fence. There were barely any tanks. I think there were a dozen tanks along about 60 kilometers of border. And the whole thing was based on cameras and sensors and these video control rooms that were run by these young women, lookouts, who were supposed to man the cameras, if that's the right word for a job that was done almost exclusively by women. And then what happened on October 7th is that Hamas, using very low-tech methods, knocks out all of our tech. So the cameras are shot out with sniper rifles, and the high-tech fence that was supposed to prevent anyone from getting into Israel, they just knock it down with bulldozers and come through with wire cutters. And the whole high-tech solution to the Gaza border is proven to be an illusion. And because it was so tech heavy, and because of our confidence, and because of our kind of idea of ourselves as the startup nation, we were incredibly arrogant, and we had completely forgotten all of the basics of defending a border. The idea that the line of contact will always be crossed. That's a key precept that I was taught when I was a very low ranking infantryman. No defense line will ever hold. We know that. That's one of the lessons of the Yom Kippur War. So you have to plan for what happens when it is crossed and never believe that it will not be crossed. And we forgot all of that because we had tech that allowed us to imagine ourselves to be immune to reality. And it all came crashing down on October 7th. And I hope that there'll be a real rethinking of how much we, you know, how many of our eggs we place in the tech basket.
Okay, another topic entirely. You've written about what you call the Americanization of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the debate. You wrote about that back in 2021, if memory serves. How are we doing in that department? Are we still looking at it through the kind of this weird lens?
Yes, I feel like I should give you an optimistic answer because you were complaining that my other answer was too depressing. But generally, unfortunately, the trend seems to be downward in these matters. I wrote an essay, I believe it was in 2021, for The Atlantic, making that point. It was called America's Problems Are Not Like Israel's, or Israel's Problems Are Not Like America's. I can't remember. It was one of those two. And it was this observation that Americans were increasingly imagining Israel not as a country in the Middle East, 8,000 miles away, but as an extension of their own racial politics. And you saw it in signs that say from Ferguson to Palestine. Those popped up around 2014 when there was the unrest in Ferguson. And it's really kind of gone, it's become more pronounced since then. You have members of Congress saying in Congress, you know, what they're doing, you know, to us here in America is what they're doing to our brothers and sisters in Palestine. And there's this attempt to draw a line between the experience of African-Americans and the experience of Arab Muslims in this part of the world. And without getting into what's better or worse, these two situations are completely unrelated to each other. The idea that Israeli Jews are somehow parallel to white Americans and that Palestinians are somehow parallel to African-Americans, that idea is insane, and it won't allow you to make any sense of the situation. But as we were saying before, often what the observers, particularly journalists and activists, are looking for is not to make sense of the situation, but to draw an easy political message. So if you tell people, well, the Israelis are actually kind of like plantation owners in the South, and the Palestinians, you know, they might seem like people who are enamored of, you know, jihad and a violence of the kind that we saw on October 7th, but actually these are people analogous to Martin Luther King. And I mean, that's crazy. And most people, I hope, see that for what it is, which is a fantasy, but it does seem to have legs on the American left. And increasingly there's this alliance between Hamas, which is a jihadi organization affiliated with the broader the broader world of the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course with the Iranians, and organizations like Black Lives Matter, which claim to represent the, you know, the very real concerns of African Americans. Nothing good will come of that, but it's definitely a very real part of the strange political landscape in America surrounding this war.
Yeah, they call it intersectionality. I think that's a delicate term here. It's a lot more insidious than that. Shifting gears again, I don't like to pick favorites, but your book, Pumpkin Flowers, about Israel's war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, I think remains my favorite from your anthology. Just curious right now how, and by the way, recommend that book to all our viewers and listeners. How do you view the tension right now in the North? This is a place where you've served. It's the place where we hear that, you know, a truly terrible war could erupt if one does. I mean, there is something that's already underway. It could get worse. How do you view what's happening right now on the northern border?
First of all, thank you for that recommendation. And I also encourage the viewers, you don't have to read it. You just have to buy it. So, definitely take Jonathan's recommendation there. What you do after you buy it is less, less important.
Put on your coffee table.
Put on your coffee table. I've owned several copies. Right. My time in Lebanon in the late 1990s was in a different era of this this conflict. It was really at the kind of early stage of the evolution of Hezbollah from this very raggedy bunch of Shia militiamen into basically an army, one of the most capable military forces in the area. And what we've seen over the past 5 months since October 7th is that Hezbollah has been attacking Israel. My parents live very close to the border. They live in a town called Nahariya. Nahariya has not been evacuated, but everything north of Nahariya has been. And I've been around there, and a swath of northern Israel has been depopulated by Hezbollah. About 70,000 people have been displaced. A whole part of, you know, Israel along the Lebanon border is uninhabitable. And because of what's going on in Gaza, that has kind of remained under the radar, but it's huge. It's an incredible success for Hezbollah to have managed to create a security zone inside Israel. I served in a security zone in the late 90s that was inside Lebanon, that was meant to keep terrorists away from the border. We pulled out of the security zone in the spring of 2000, and now we have a security zone on our own territory. So the trend is not in our favor, and something is going to have to happen in order to reverse that. Israelis cannot go back to their homes on the border if Hezbollah is on the fence, because October 7th could repeat itself on the northern border, and quite reasonably, people won't go back. Something has to happen to push the Hezbollah guys back. There are two options. One is diplomacy. The other is a military action. The diplomacy option is obviously preferable, but I think is very unlikely, not because we don't want it, but because Hezbollah doesn't want it. The option two is a war. And a war with Hezbollah is going to be much worse than the war that we're seeing with Hamas. I wrote an article about it for the Free Press a couple of weeks ago, which asks the question, has the real war not started yet? Which is a kind of a terrifying question, but one that is, I think, apt. It's possible that the war has not yet started, that we're still in a preliminary phase of the real war, which will start once things get going in Lebanon. Hezbollah has many more rockets than Hamas. It's better trained. It's closer with the Iranians. It's a much more significant military force. And war with Hezbollah is a kind of war that Israelis have not experienced in the history of the state. And if other Iranian proxies get involved, and if the Iranians themselves get involved, then of course it's even worse. So part of the dread in Israel right now is not just, you know, how awful things are in Gaza, but the very real possibility that we're facing something big and scary in the north. I've no doubt that will prevail, but if it happens in the north, it's going to be very, very bad.
We've been warning about that from day one here at The Morning Brief. Lastly, you got about a minute left. You're a writer who likes to hit them where they ain't, to borrow a baseball phrase, and it is spring training after all. What should we be watching right now that is not on the media radar? Is there a story that you are particularly interested in right now?
First of all, you know, it's true that you and FDD have been way out in front on the Hezbollah and Iran issue for a very long time, and I think that, you know, we salute you for that. It's certainly true. And even when things seem to be focused somewhere else, it's always a good idea to keep an eye on Hezbollah. And I know that you do, and that is absolutely the right approach. And just to kind of continue in that line, everyone is watching Gaza. It seems that the American administration is very preoccupied with Gaza. People see Hezbollah in Lebanon as a kind of a sideshow or the backyard. But what Hezbollah is up to right now and what the Iranians are up to right now is extremely important, and I think will ultimately be seen as more important than what's happening in Gaza. If I were the Iranians right now, I would be making a move toward nuclear weapons. it seems like something like that is happening. Clearly, this is a moment of opportunity for the Iranians. It's also a dangerous moment, but they have, Israel's credibility is running pretty low. The Middle East is inflamed in many ways. The American administration seems increasingly confused and unwilling to really hit hard. I mean, international shipping has been under threat from an Iranian proxy for months. Many ships have been damaged. Some sailors were just killed. It's disrupting international commerce. And the U.S. has, done a few things, but nothing too aggressive, nothing to go after the guys who are actually orchestrating all of these events. And I think that it's clear, if you're an observer, that this would be a good time to make a move, because things might change and you might not ever get such a good opportunity. So I think it's a very good idea not to, obviously you have to keep one eye on Gaza, but we can't forget that there are a lot of other players here in the Middle East, and they're all very canny and very smart, and they probably see an opportunity here. And if I were them, I would be seizing it.
I think that's right. And we'll certainly be watching that in the weeks and maybe months to come. Thank you, Mati Friedman, for taking time out to join us today. Appreciate you joining the Morning Brief.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, here's what FDD has on tap for you today. As Congress considers legislation to force the sale of TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, FDD's China program is putting out great info for policymakers and the wider public to grapple with the issue. Check out the 5 things you need to know about ByteDance. That's on FDD's website. It's an accessible but stark look at ByteDance's close ties with the Chinese Communist Party and what's at stake for U.S. national security. The head of FDD's non-proliferation program, Anthony Ruggiero, was up on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Russia's state-run nuclear corporation, Rosatom. He delivered a series of policy recommendations for how Congress and the administration could begin to cut off this critical Kremlin revenue stream. I encourage you to check out that testimony. And finally, our cyber program will be hosting an event today at FDD to mark the release of a series of recommendations by President Biden's Council on Advisors on Science and Technology. FDD Chief Technologist George Shea, who sat on the Council's Working Group on Cyber Resilience, will be joined on stage by the White House's National Cyber Director, as well as senior officials from Google and Microsoft. This will be a lineup of heavy hitters, so do tune in live at 3 p.m. Eastern. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD, and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Friday for another installment of the FDD Morning Brief. We'll be speaking to former IDF spokesman and now current FDD senior fellow, Jonathan Conricus. Jonathan will be the Morning Brief's first returning guest. We heard what he had to say back in November when he was an official on reserve duty at the IDF. We'll hear what he has to say on Friday now that he's unleashed and out of uniform. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD.